But we're going to pick on church leadership. And so he gives some qualifications for that. Here's something I want to say before I get into that. Keep in mind that, you know, when we're dealing with church leadership, it's like anything else. The farther up the ladder you go in anything, the more that is expected of you, the more responsibility, the more qualifications, the more of a lot of things. And so, you know, it's no different within the church. And so, you know, wherever the position lies that you wind up being a leader in one position or another, there is greater expectations upon you than even the people below you. Now, we'll say this, and I know within certain churches, they'll, and I've even heard them say this in Baptist churches, and I hate the terminology. I hate it. But sometimes they'll define it by clergy and laity. And if you've ever worked a crossword puzzle, you'll understand and know why that laity is such a terrible word. Because the idea in clergy and laity is that they believe that the clergy just, you know, knows more, and that the laity cannot possibly know what the clergy would know because they don't have the ability, they don't have the sense, they don't have the spirituality to know and to be able to understand the things that clergy can understand. And I do not believe that. I think that the responsibility to study to show yourself approved is a responsibility everyone has. And I'm smart enough to know that when I'm preaching, even on a Sunday morning, I'm preaching to people who know less than me, and I'm preaching to people who know more than me. And it's just the way it is. And I'm not in a position where I always know more than you know. I am just in that position of responsibility where I'm obligated to study and to know more of what God would have us to do and the direction God would have us to go. And I spend more time and more effort and more dedication to that rather than having to hold a secular job. All right. Now, the word laity means secular. And that's what bothers me. Just simply because someone doesn't hold a position in the church, or because they are not, you know, the pastor, or they're not a deacon, or whatever the case may be, doesn't mean that they're secular. Because when I think of secular, I think more along the lines of carnal, you know, where they're adhering more to the flesh than they are to the things of God. And I just don't believe that's true. I believe there are folks that are, don't get me wrong, but I'm saying that's not just an overall thing. And I hate referring to the congregation as the laity, because I think it's a slap in the face. And I personally believe that that whole clergy and laity thing is a reflection of the Nicolaitan doctrine that you find over in Revelation, where he condemns them for adhering to the doctrine of the Nicolaitans, where you have a hierarchy over those that are not, and that, you know, chain the Bible to the pulpit because nobody else can study it, because if they do, they'll misunderstand it and not know what to do, and only the people behind the pulpit can do it. I just don't hold to those things, all right? So my point being is these are positions that are given not because someone knows more, but because God has called them and chosen them to those positions, all right? So it's just as simple as that. And the first that you see is he'll use the word bishop. The word bishop, from everything I have studied, from everything that I know, means overseer, and it has to do more with the senior pastor. You take a church the size of the church in Jerusalem, who had 3,000 saved at one point, 5,000 another, and multitudes at another point, and, you know, they're growing in leaps and bounds. Who knows how many thousands of people are a part of the local church there in Jerusalem? Obviously, they had more than one pastor. All right. And so all the pastors would, you know, be a culmination of the elders of the church. But there was always that one that was the senior pastor, the bishop. In the case of Jerusalem, for example, it seems to be that James, the brother of Jesus, or the half-brother of Jesus, would have been the pastor. We see that because when Barnabas and Paul comes back to the church of Antioch and disputes over some things that are being taught at Antioch from some people that had come there from Jerusalem, he went back and said, hey, listen, you can't be coming there and teaching the law. And they discussed it back and forth. Even Peter had a say in it. Paul, Barnabas, they had say in it. And so some people spoke. But ultimately, the conversation ended when James, the pastor, when James got up and said, this is what we'll do. And everybody said, okay. All right. And so it seems that he was the senior pastor of that church, which means he was even over and above the apostles that were in the church. It was his church to oversee. And so the bishop is that senior pastor. Now, it's important that you see this because when he tells you in chapter 3, this is a true saying, if a man desire the office of bishop, he desireth a good work. There is that ability or that desire to be the bishop. Now, if you take a church that's large enough that they have associate pastors and they've got maybe a whole group of pastors, those men who feel and people agree that they are called of God to preach and to share the gospel, to minister, so much so they've made them a part of the church and said, yeah, we want you to be these in this position. They felt that way. Now, that's all a calling from God. That doesn't come from a desire of man. But once you have been called to that position, once you know what God has called you to do, there is nothing wrong with then desiring to move up the ladder. God's called me to this, and yes, I desire to move up to this, or I aspire to do this, or to do that. And there's nothing wrong with that. Anybody would want that. If God has used you in that capacity, you ought to desire to further yourself and, you know, and do those things. That's why he says, for anyone who would desire the office of bishop, rather than, you know, be just one of the elders of the church, which I shouldn't use the word just, but you know what I'm saying, to be one of the elders of the church, there might be some who are satisfied with that, but to aspire to be the bishop would be something that they would long for and desire. And I'm going to tell you this, I believe with all my heart that it's the highest calling that is given in the world, literally. I do believe that. I believe to pastor a church is the highest calling that you could receive in the world. And I like, you know, regardless of what you believe or what you think about Billy Graham, he made a statement one time that I thought was a pretty cool statement. And I probably won't quote it exactly, but I'll get close enough, you'll get the idea. But he had been, for a time there, he was under pursuit to run for president. People wanted him to be president. And he pretty much just put him in their place, and he said, listen, I can't do that. You know, and you would sit back and you think, well, of course you can't, because God called you to preach, or God called you to share the gospel, or whatever the case may be. And he said, I can't do that because I cannot and will not and refuse to step down from what God has called me to do. And I thought that was a good statement, you know. When God calls you to a position, when God calls you to a place, anything less than that would be literally to step down from what God would desire for you to be and for what God would want you to do. So he tells you that this idea of being a bishop, if you were to desire that, it's a good work. If there's something to desire, that's a good thing to desire. I mean, for example, we see God's passion for his sheep. You know, when he refers to Jerusalem, and he's looking at them in the city, and they're wandering around without a shepherd, and he cries. I mean, he weeps over this thing. And you think about how he must have a passion for those. And then you see later, he tells Peter, he says, feed my sheep. So when I'm thinking about being a pastor, and the first and foremost goal of being a pastor is to feed the sheep, contrary to what a lot of people might think, it is something that says this is God's will. This is what he apparently wants more than anything else. Because some of the very last things and last instructions he gave to those guys, Peter, feed my sheep. Feed my sheep, all right? And that was so important to him, that his congregation or his flock be fed. And that's why I believe the people who are feeding the sheep are of the highest calling, because that seems to be what God desired most of his people to do. And so when we talk about being a good work, how can you not think it to be a good work when you see that picture of feeding the sheep and doing what God called us to do? I heard a pastor say this week, you know, when I think about preaching, and I think about pastoring, and sometimes you get, it's kind of a strange thing, but sometimes you feel kind of out there all by yourself. It just, I think it comes with the territory. I mean, I think it just is. But he made this statement that I thought was really a cool statement, and I've been there and felt it and sensed it, because maybe my life wasn't where I needed to be when I needed to be. And he said, the loneliest place for a preacher, the loneliest place for a preacher is in the pulpit without God. And boy, I was actually thinking about that, and I thought, oh man, isn't that the truth? Man, I've been there at times where I have relied upon what I've studied, and I've relied upon what I can say, and I've relied upon what I can do, and I've relied upon my charisma or my abilities, and forgot. You know what? This is not about me. It's about God. It's what He wants me to do. And I need Him and while standing here and while presenting these things, while feeding the sheep. Man, I need Him more than ever. And it is a lonely place when you step behind that pulpit and realize that you've left God out of the picture. It is a lonely, lonely place. So those that desire the office of a bishop, who understand it's a good work and would apply themselves and be what God would have them to be, and understand there are qualifications for that, and you want and desire to do what God would have you to do, I got to tell you, it is a good work that you desire. And that's what he's talking about. All right? Then verses 2 through 7, he gets into all the different qualifications, responsibilities, all the things that need to take place. And as we walk through these, just so you know, some of them are controversial. Some are not. Some are just plain and easy to see. But we do want to take a look. Because being a bishop, as wonderful of a job as it is, as neat a thing. I mean, I want you to think about my job for a second. I mean, think about what I do. Anybody who really loves the Lord, anybody who really desires to just do everything God would have them to do, I have the ideal job. My job is to pray, study, preach, share God's word, feed the flock, mentor those that need to, you know, come along and learn. I mean, it's my job. Couldn't you ask for a better job? In all honesty, for a person who loves the Lord, for a person who desires to do what God would have him to do, can you think of a better job? You know, and to have the privilege and the opportunity to do it without anything else in their way as in regard to another job. I could do it in such a fashion because you've afforded me the privilege of doing so. I can do it on a full-time basis so that I can focus on it more of the day and more of my time. Man, what a privilege. And so when I think about that, I think, man, that's so awesome. But there is a catch. There is a catch. And the catch is there are responsibilities, all right? It's not just to do as you please and run amok if you choose. You know, there's responsibilities. There's qualifications. You know, there has to be that passion. And there is also accountability. You know, accountability. In a couple of sources, you guys, by the way, I'm accountable to you, but I'm mostly accountable to God. And I have to make sure that what I'm doing is pleasing unto God. And I have to tell you, as cool as my job is, it is also that little element of fear, you know, that God, I know I'm accountable to you. And there are times where I feel like, you know, I didn't do what I should do. And it's kind of is frightening because I feel like God, I know you're going to hold me accountable to this, you know, and there is that. And so, you know, we're going to walk through these and you kind of see what I'm talking about as we go. All right. And it's frightening when a lot of people will use the pulpit with a total and complete disregard for the qualifications. And it's amazing at the number of people that will replace these qualifications with just a cool personality or charisma, talent, whatever the case may be, rather than understanding and knowing, listen, there's qualifications for this thing. And it amazes me at the number of churches that are willing to throw somebody up there regardless of what they believe, what they teach, because they're cool, you know, or they'll draw a crowd or they'll whatever, you know. And I got to tell you now, every evangelist is not a pastor. Every preacher is not a pastor, you know, and every Sunday school teacher is not a pastor. And it's important to understand that though they have a role and they have important ministries, everybody has a ministry and has that work, and we need to be where God can best use us. And sometimes we get the idea, man, I went to that revival and that guy's so awesome. That's, oh man, you just heard him preach. I'd love for him to be my pastor. Well, that's not always the case, just so you know. You might not love for them to be your pastor because while they might be great preachers, they might be a lousy pastor, you know. And so there you have it. Qualifications. Picking up in verse 2, unto Timothy, mine own son in the faith, grace, mercy, peace from God our Father. And I don't know why I'm reading chapter 1, but you probably needed it for some reason. Chapter 3, verse 2, a bishop then must be blameless. He starts with blameless. All right. The idea of being blameless doesn't mean that he, you know, that somebody couldn't make up some false accusation against you. They could. But what it means is, if they did, you probably wouldn't believe it because you know the person. And it's like, there's no way I would believe that about him. I think that is such an important thing because I know pastors that fear. I mean, they live their life in fear that somebody's going to accuse them of something. And we've talked about it. And I said, guys, live your life so that the people that you care about won't believe it. You know, if somebody comes along and says, you know, do you believe, I saw Pastor Barry do this, and live your life so that the people that you are preaching to and that you're feeding and that you care for, they'd say, I would never believe that about my pastor. I do not believe you. You know, and that's where we have to be. Our life needs to be a life where people can say, no, that's not true. I'll be real honest. I've had lots of times in my life where people have come to me and accused people that I know, whether it be people in my congregation, people that I know, you know, other pastor friends and that kind of thing. They say, did you know? And immediately, I'll just tell you, if I know the person and I know better, I tell them that, no, I don't believe that. That's a lie. Throw it away. You need to not believe everything that you see, everything that you hear. That would not be true about that individual. I can tell you firsthand, I know them, and they would not do that. We need to live a life so if somebody accuses us of something, that you would know better. You know, so that if somebody comes along just trying to do us harm, just trying to tear us down, just trying to hurt the ministry, that the people would say that would never happen in my pastor's life. That's the kind of life we need to live. When he talks about being blameless, he's talking about living that life so that people cannot blame you for things that, you know, that others might would grasp hold of and then people believe it. All right, you got to be blameless. You got to be living a life that people say, nope, he's not. You're a liar. You're telling an untruth. That's not what he would be, and that's not what he would do. And so, you know, blaming you for things in the present, you know, they could be, you don't want to be blamed. You don't want to give evidence that you could be a liar. You could be a thief. You could be whatever else that you want to name or whatever else you want to throw out there. I've seen some folks whose lives have been destroyed over things they didn't do. I knew a man, as a matter of fact. I mean, I've seen some whose lives were destroyed over things they did do as well. But I know of some whose lives were destroyed over things they didn't do. And when they came to me and they said, did you know and did you hear? I told them, I cannot believe and I will not believe that he would ever do that. I said, before you tell anybody else, you better get better evidence because I'm going to tell you now, they cannot, they wouldn't do that. And man, it got nasty, it got bad, and come out in the end, truly, he hadn't done it. After he lost his wife, after he lost his church. And it was like, that's a shame. People knew better. But people enjoy hearing dirt. People like that nastiness. They like spreading gossip. Our church is no different, by the way. I can guarantee you, if somebody come, there are certain people, they would come to them and say, did you hear, did you know? Man, before you know it, it's all over the church. And it may not even be true. It's sad. We need to be a people, by the way, who will hold people accountable to what they say. Don't come to me and say something that you don't know the details about. Because I'm going to tell you now, you know, we're going to go talk to that person. And some of you here probably already know me in that because you've witnessed it. Where I've had people say, you know, they said, no, let's go. And I'll grab you by the arm and we go and go face to face right then and there. Because quite frankly, I don't like that. Don't accuse people. And the pastor especially, my job depends upon reputation. And if you tell people that I'm a liar, if you tell people I'm a thief, or if you tell people that, you know, I don't understand the wisdom that God has given, I don't know God's direction, if you do that stuff, I'm going to tell you now, we'll go nowhere because we will fail. You've got to understand and know. Your pastor has to be blameless. That's every bit as much of my qualification as it has to be yours because you have to be able to see that as well. All right, and you have to defend that. All right? So keep that in mind. Second one, and the second one, you thought we'd spend some time on blameless. The second one is one that there is probably the biggest issue in regard to ministry. And it has to do with this. He says, I don't know why I keep looking in chapter one. A bishop then must be blameless, the husband of one wife. Now, this is not really, to me, all that complicated. I think if you just take it at face value, it's pretty easy to figure out. But we'll have to deal with it just a little bit because it is a very controversial issue. There are a lot of people that believe that this has absolutely nothing to do with marital status, but everything to do with just faithfulness to the woman you're with. And by believing it in that fashion, what they believe is if it just means that I need to be faithful with the wife that I have, then that means I could have been married as many times as whatever, all right? As long as I'm just faithful to my wife. Now, there are a lot of people that believe that's what it means. There are also a lot of people that believe that it deals with polygamy. You can only have one wife at a time. And I will admit this, that in their day and time, that was a bit of an issue. There were folks that would have more than one wife, and it seemed to be an acceptable thing within their crowd. And Paul was saying, hey, listen, Timothy, if they got a guy out here with multiple wives, they wouldn't be suitable for the ministry because, you know, there's too much focus on all that. And they need to be focused here. All right. But I still don't believe that's what it's dealing with. I think that would have been clearer. I think he would have said it more clearly had that been the case. I think he would have said they need to put away those other wives or he needs to. I think there'd have been more clarification if that were the case. I really do believe that what he's dealing with here is that this pastor, the bishop, the one in charge, ought to be an individual who's only been married to one woman. Husband of one wife. Now, when you look at this picture, you know, obviously we agree that if it's dealing with polygamy, we also agree that a guy with multiple wives would not be qualified for the ministry. I think that kind of goes without saying. But when we look at this picture of it dealing with a possibility that perhaps if you were divorced, you would not qualify, we have to kind of take a look at how God looks at marriage. Now, I want you to understand this, and this is important, because I've also had pastors say, well, then what you're saying is that God's not a forgiving God. He didn't forgive me for my divorce. No, I'm not saying that at all. I think God's a very forgiving God, and I don't think it has anything to do with whether or not he's forgiven you. He may very well have forgiven you, but that doesn't mean that you meet his qualifications. All right, there are standards that must be met regardless of whether or not he's forgiven you. You know, every sin, by the way, has repercussions. I mean, it has things that are attached. All right, it always has the consequences, I guess would be a better word. Everything we do has consequences. And we need to understand that. I mean, if you had if you had sex outside of marriage and you had a child as a result of that, when you get married, it doesn't mean you kill the child because it was wrong to have, that'd be stupid, all right? But the sin has consequences. You have the child, okay? And you have responsibility because of it. And so you go on, okay? The same thing is true. It changes who you are and it changes some of the things and it changes some of what you can do, like it or not. And so in this regard, if you look back in Mark chapter 10, where Jesus talks about marriage, and I'm not going to get into the whole issue of marriage, but there is a point I want to make that goes with this. In Mark chapter 10, verse 6, we see this. But from the beginning of the creation of God, God made them male and female. For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and the twain shall be one flesh. So then they are no more twain, but one flesh. What therefore God hath joined together, let no man put asunder. Now this is a hard, hard, hard statement and one that folks don't want to always hear. But like it or not, if two come together in marriage, in God's sight they will always be one flesh. Like it or not. You can, you know, and he gives provisions for divorce. Don't get me wrong. He does give provisions. But in God's sight, he said, no decree that man gives is going to separate what God has already done. All right? So like it or not, even if the divorce was hard, even if it was a terrible thing, if there was sin involved, there is still no man can put asunder what God has joined. Now, here is what we see about that. Because First of all, he tells us it's between man and woman. So we know that this doesn't involve a homosexual relationship, all right? Not a homosexual union. But the two become one. God joins them together, and regardless of whether or not what reason the divorce took place, God doesn't divide them. He sees them as one flesh, all right? He says that. Now, if you back up a verse right before where we started at that verse 6, Mark chapter 10, verse 5 says this, because they said, well, wait a minute, didn't Moses give us the opportunity to have a bill of divorcement? And so he says, and Jesus answered and said unto them, for the hardness of your heart, he wrote you this precept. But you see, but in God's sight, like it or not, there is still a union that he sees, all right? Now, again, God allows divorce in certain circumstances. He allows it when you've been abandoned. He allows it for fornication, all right? We see that he does allow man to write a bill of divorcement. But the difference and the problem is that God still sees that union that he established. And he still sees that one flesh. And because of that, in God's sight, he sees two people that you're tied together with. Let me give you an illustration of that. When Jesus met the woman at the well, all right? When he met the woman at the well and he told her all that she was, what did he tell her? You remember what he told her about her marital status? Anybody know? You've had five husbands, and the guy you're living with is not your husband. He called every one of those guys a husband. He used the word husband for every single one of them. Now, the whole phrase here in this picture is a one-woman man, all right? So the idea is, in order to be a bishop, not because God doesn't forgive sin, not because God doesn't forgive you if you're divorced, he does. That's like anything else we've done in life. When we fail, we bring it to God, we repent, he forgives us. Like it or not, I mean, he loves us and cares for us. I don't know why you would not like that, but he does. But it does change what we're qualified to do and what we're not qualified to do, because God sees it differently than we see it. Part of that is this reason. God is omnipresent. God being omnipresent doesn't simply mean he's on this side of the earth and on that side of the earth at the same time. It means he is every place in time at the same time. And so what I'm saying is, because he is always present, he sees you with this husband and sees you with this husband all at the same time. You see what I'm saying? So from God's view, he can see you with every one of those husbands at the same moment. I mean, that's hard for us to imagine, but Jesus Christ is on the cross at the same time. God is present as Jesus on the cross, and it's all happening at the same time as Jesus is returning, because time is not a factor. And so in our life, he sees our life as one whole thing, all right? And so he sees this marriage and this marriage and this marriage all together, okay? So that's the picture, and I think that's what a lot of people tend to miss. And by the way, it's the same qualification he actually gives to the widows. Did you know that? When he calls the widows, we'll talk about this when we get over in chapter 5, is it? Yeah, chapter 5. When he says, you know, that the widows, that are widows indeed, you can take into the congregation of the church, and that basically it seems what they used to do was they would take these widows in, they'd feed them and take care of them when they didn't have family to take care of them, and the widows would commit themselves to the church, okay, and to the work of the church. And so he says, don't do that if they're young widows. We'll talk about that later. But he talks about the idea of the elderly widows. And he says, let not a widow, verse 9, 1 Timothy 5, 9, let not a widow be taken into the number under 80 years old. So don't take any widows in under 60. Having been the wife of one man. All right? If she's been the wife of one man, you can take her in. But if not, you can't. So it's apparently a pretty important issue for God when he's using these individuals for a leadership role in the church. And these widows, by the way, had a huge leadership role among the women. All right, they would teach the young women and several other things. And he did so, used them, because they understood what it meant to be devoted to that one man and devoted to that home. And that's who he wanted to teach those young ladies. All right, so that's the picture. So the conclusion is pretty simple. Obviously, he's not to be a polygamous man. Obviously, he's supposed to be devoted to his wife. But even more so, the bishop is to only have been married once. All right. There are some issues that I guess you could throw out there that I'll speak to later, actually, but when it talks about ruling well his household and that kind of thing. But some will say, well, what if his wife leaves him and he doesn't remarry? Can he continue to pastor? And we'll deal with that when we get down to where he's ruling his own household well. All right. And by the way, this is not an issue, as I said, of whether or not God's forgiven the individual. And it's not even beating up on people who are divorced. I don't know your situation, and I don't know what God you've had to deal with the individuals, and that's between you and God, and God is a forgiving God regardless. All right? So when you look at this, keep in mind that just the idea of qualifications, it's a standard. Yeah. No, it would not. And the reason we know that is because it talks about the fact that, they even are encouraged to take on another wife if that one passes away. It tells you, you know, if your heart burns, if it's, you know, if it causes you, you know, to sin with your thoughts and all that kind of stuff, you're better off take a wife. So, no, it would not apply to that. All right. That was a good question, though. All right. By the way, it also would be obvious that this is to be a male. All right. He says the husband of one wife. And as we already talked about last week, the woman's not to usurp authority over the man when we're talking about church issues. So the bishop, the lead pastor, would have to be a male. All right. Any questions about that or a thought? We can do that. We're not on live stream. So, yeah. Yeah. Well, God, and part of that's because God, like I said before, God sees all in one picture. You know, we see things, you know, this happened today, that happens tomorrow, and this happens the next day. We see it like that, but God sees it all in one picture. And that's what we can't fathom, is how God sees all that at one time. And so he sees, you know, the picture, the whole picture at once. Let me throw a couple of things. I wasn't going to mention these, but just to throw them at you and not give you any answers. There are those who, because of this, believe that a man should not pastor if he's not married. There are also those who believe that a man should not pastor if he doesn't have children, because it says that the children should be, later on, talks about ruling the household and the audience, children should be kept in order. I will tell you my opinion, but quite frankly, it's a difficult situation because he doesn't really talk to that. But I think, to me, it seems evident that he's saying if he's married, should only be married to one wife. If he has children, they need to be, even though it doesn't use the word if, it doesn't say that. But to me, it seems to be just a qualification for those who do. All right, that's my opinion. So I don't think that a pastor necessarily has to be married. I would think that, you know, that might be better not to be, you know. Paul even talks about that. You know, you'd be better off if you can do what I can do, but if you can't, better to marry. And as far as the children, I think that's ludicrous to think he just has to have children. I don't think that's the case, but we'll talk about that more when we get down there probably. All right? So any other questions about that? Yeah. Yeah. Well, see, yeah, and that's irrelevant. And the reason being is because what we're talking about here is solely, that's a good question, a good comment. What we're talking about here is holding the position of a bishop, all right, to be the pastor. We're not talking about whether or not you can preach the gospel. We're not talking about whether you can do mission work, evangelize. We're not talking about anything else. In fact, the only place you're going to find in Scripture where this is an issue as far as the positions that you hold is dealing with the pastor and the deacons. And that's the only place. We want to be really careful about this because honest to goodness, you don't want to read into Scripture what's not in Scripture. And sometimes, if we're not careful, we will decide, because that's a qualification for the most responsible position in the church, it must be the qualification for other things as well. And it's not. It's not. Okay? So don't hold that as a, you know, as a qualification for individuals that have other positions or do other things. All right? It's for the pastor. All right? Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And that's more common than people realize. I know churches that would not let a man teach if they were divorced. I know one that specifically told me right to my face that they wouldn't even let him work with their children's ministries if they were divorced. And I thought, well, you know, it's up to you, but that's not Bible. I mean, it's nowhere in Scripture that says that. The only place, the only thing that we're told is in regard to the pastor and the deacons. That's it. So try and, you know, don't get too hung up on making up rules where the rules aren't, all right? And when we do that too, you know, it makes people get the idea. And I mean, there's already enough of that where people think that we're just off, you know, off the edge anyway. So let's not make up a bunch of stuff that's not in the Bible. And if we're not careful, people do that with not just this issue, but a whole lot of other issues as well. We want to be really careful. If the Bible speaks to it, we speak to it. If the Bible doesn't, we shouldn't. All right? It's okay to have opinions. It's okay to have your ideas. But it can't be a church doctrine. It can't be something we stand on. All right? So, good. Good stuff. All right? Any other questions or thoughts? Something I've overlooked in that. All right? Yeah, I've got time for a little bit more. The next one is, he says, there must be blameless, the husband and one wife. Vigilant. You guys know what the word vigilant means? Alert, ready, on the watch. You know, Ezekiel was called to be the watchman. And it's the idea that if you want to be the bishop, man, you need to always be on watch, be on guard to the approaching enemy, to false doctrines, to anything that can creep in and destroy the church. We got to be on guard. You need to be able to trust your pastor to watch out for such things and sound the warning, sound the alarm if something is on the horizon or if something's coming up. And so the bishop needs to be on watch for heresy, maybe Satan's attacks, or, you know, careful not to let down his guard, because it's easy to get caught up in so many other things that we let down our guard. I'm going to tell you here's something. This being a pastor, I want to share this because it's easy to fall into this. Sometimes you get so bogged down and tied down with the administration end of church, the politics of the church, all the things of the church that you are the things you don't like, the things, you know, the part of being a pastor that in all honesty you didn't bargain for, you know, and if you're not careful, you get bogged down with a lot of those things, and it kind of takes you off your watch, takes you off guard. And things happen and things hit you that you didn't see coming. And it's one of those things that you really have to watch and be careful for. Not everybody is as privileged as I am. Scotty's a great man, and he's always on guard for that kind of stuff as well. It's not everybody that has deacons that are like that. I happen to have a deacon that's like that, that will, you know, help me with those things and ward off things. And he's on my side, and he loves his pastor, and that's important. And because of that, it puts that right-hand man beside you so that when you do let down your guard some, you know, you've got that Joab that steps up and says, oh, no, this ain't going to happen, you know. And so being vigilant is important so that you can ward off a lot of the things that could be destructive for the church and for the people. And then he says, sober. Now, a lot of people think of the word sober, and immediately we think, well, you know, you shouldn't be a drunk guy. But the word sober really has more of an idea of being clear-headed and rational about what you do, all right? Always kind of keeping your head clear from the outside world. Keep your head clear of secular things so that you can make good decisions, all right? Good rational decisions, reasonable decisions. You hear often where it talks about Jesus said, come, let us reason together. The reason for that is because, you know, let's look at this from a very rational view, and let's make sure that we're doing the right thing and making a sensible decision. And it's a pastor's job. Above everybody else, it's the pastor's job. Not that other people shouldn't be a part of that and shouldn't be wise counsel to that. And by the way, a good pastor who is sober-minded is going to have wise counsel that he surrounds himself with. And so what happens is he needs to be real clear-headed so that, you know, he's not bogged down with so much stuff that he can't see what needs to be done and that he can't see beyond the things that are just honestly, just reasonable so that there's no deception that creeps in. And then he talks about good behavior. I think a bishop has to behave himself in an orderly fashion, a workman approved of God, all right, desiring to be pleasing unto the Lord. His behavior ought to be the behavior that that is pleasing unto God. That God says, look, this is the way I want you to do. This is what I want you to do. And I'm one of those guys that really think that you should, you know, go overboard with some of that. I mean, just go overboard with it. It's one of those where, you know, we would, when I was a kid, my cousins had horses down on the farm. And we would ride, when I'd go down there in Kentucky, we'd get on the horses, and we'd ride back in the woods. And very often there were big steep ledges and there were, you know, like yay wide paths that we walk around on with those horses. And I mean, if a horse would stumble or anything like that, it could be a bad deal, you know. You could plunge pretty far down. And so, you know, we'd be riding along on those horses. And of course, they're just riding along. They're used to the horse. I'm not. All right. It don't take much for me to fall off the horse because I don't ride horses as much. You know, I'm from the city. And you know, it didn't take much for me to, yeah, I mean, I could just fall off just riding along because, you know, I'm just not as adept at it. And they just ride along not thinking about anything. And man, the whole time I've got my horse as close to the wall this side as I could take it without, you know, knocking me off. Because I wanted to get as far away from that edge as I could get. I really feel like as a pastor, that's where we need to walk. As far away from that edge as we can walk. And it scares me today. Even pastors I love and respect, seems to me sometimes that they walk awfully close to that edge. I don't always know where the edge is. I don't always know where the line is. You know, we talk about a lot of different things. We might be talking about music. We might be talking about dress. We might be talking about a lot of things that the Bible isn't really, really super clear on. And I don't know where that line is. You know, when do you actually step over that line and when don't you? I don't know where that line is all the time. So the safe thing to do is stay as far behind the line as you can, and you know you're okay. And that's kind of my thought pattern. And so when I think about this idea of good behavior, I think about it in terms of, listen, I'm going to stay so far behind that line, nobody can, you know, God's going to be okay with it. You know, I just stay way clear. Now, maybe I could have went closer. Maybe we could have stepped out a little more. Maybe we could, but I don't know that it's safe. I don't think that's safe ground. And I see a lot of churches that I feel like, in my mind, that once upon a time were really good churches that I feel like have stepped over the line because they kept getting closer and closer and closer and just finally went beyond where they needed to go. And though a lot of people that don't know any better will like that and will enjoy that because their flesh likes it, I'm not going there. And will it cost us people from time to time? Yeah. Yeah, it will. But I'm just going to tell you, what it won't cost us is the love of God. Because I think he'll appreciate that we made every effort to stay where we needed to stay. I try to do that in my own life. And so that's where we're at with that. All right, I'm going to have to stop there. We're done. So I don't have anything to mark that with, so I'm just going to try to remember where it is. There we go. I got it. I'll just fold it there.